All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am reacting to the Falcons' dismissal of their three coordinators, offensive coordinator Steve Sarkisian, defensive coordinator Marquand Manuel, and special teams coordinator Keith Armstrong.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com, on Twitter at FalcFans, and of course, the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, I am giving you my rapid reaction, so to speak, recording a couple of hours after news broke that the Falcons were purging all three of their coordinators, Steve Sarkisian on offense, Marquand Manuel on defense, Keith Armstrong on special teams. Big decisions. You know, we speculated roughly a month ago after sort of that Ravens loss that, you know, this was potentially a possibility in addition to the possibility that sort of Dan Quinn might not necessarily be on sort of as safe ground. And so what this move, you could certainly buy the notion that this move sort of makes 2019 a make-break year for Dan Quinn. That, you know, whether it's playoffs or bust, whether I don't think it's going to be Super Bowl or bust, but I certainly think playoffs is a good starting point, or at least having a winning season going 9-7 or say 8-7-1 is a start for him to sort of retain his job beyond that, in large part due to what I've discussed on previous episodes where basically Arthur Blank doesn't, I think as Vaughn McClure of ESPN put it, he does not abide mediocrity. We'll sort of see how that plays out, and we'll certainly be discussing that very topic from here until the start of the 2019 season until September. But let's jump right in and let's talk about these moves. Let's start with Keith Armstrong, the guy who I've probably been the most public defender of on this podcast over recent years. A lot of that is due to the fact that I think it's unfair that he tends to get blame for execution issues where a guy misses a block or a guy misses a tackle on special teams or something goes awry on special teams and it's automatically Keith Armstrong's fault as if like he is out there making tackles and making blocks and all those various things that tend to go awry on special teams. I think another part of it is when I started reviewing games back in 2009, I remember for those first couple of years on FalcFans.com, in my Moneyball reviews, I would constantly write about some decision that, you know, roster decision or whatever that the Falcons had made on special teams that didn't make sense to me. And after a couple of years of doing that, I sort of just came to the realization that, like, every year there's going to be a baffling, head-scratching decision that the Falcons make under Keith Armstrong, and you just sort of have to live with that. And so by the time we get to, you know, the time where I'm doing this daily podcast since 2016, you know, it's been like 7-8 years of me sort of understanding that. And so to me, some of the head scratching decisions that other people have about the Falcons' various special teams decisions over the years have not been sort of as baffling to me because it's like, oh, that's just Keith Armstrong and there's always going to be something. And for this season, it seemed like that head scratching decision was the decision to put Justin Hardy on punt. And sort of where I'll close out this Keith Armstrong discussion is just to give the reason why I think the Falcons did that. You know, I mentioned on, before we get there, I mentioned on yesterday's podcast on the rapid reaction to the Week 17 game that it seemed feasible to me that the Falcons could part ways with Keith Armstrong just to get sort of a fresh start. That's sort of what Dan Quinn indicated when asked about why he dismissed Keith Armstrong. And because that fits the narrative that I want to push, then I'm just going to buy that at face value. If it was any other thing, if he had said the same thing about Steve Sarkisian, I'm like, I don't know if I buy that. But I think, you know, after 11 years trying to get a fresh face in here, trying to get some nuance, and particularly with the subtle background flavor of coaching for your job, maybe you want to see if you can get infuse the special teams with something a little bit different. But going back to sort of why Justin Hardy was returning punts, my personal theory, and no insight into this, but my personal theory is various roster decisions that the Falcons have made over, particularly in this past year, sort of marginalized Justin Hardy's role on offense and special teams. And so the only justification for the Falcons to continue to keep him active on game days was basically to give him this job on punt returns. And what I mean by that is when you look at Justin Hardy, what he did in his first 2.5 years, and that stopped midway through last season in or after that Seahawks game, and I think it was, again, speculation again, but I think it was due to the fact that, you know, he had postseason shoulder injury, and shoulder surgery, and I imagine he injured his shoulder, and having him be the gunner on punt coverage and covering kickoffs was probably not necessarily the greatest thing that you would want to do with a guy playing with a bum shoulder. But so prior to that, Justin Hardy was one of their most reliable coverage guys on special teams. He was a gunner on punt teams. He was a regular on kickoff coverage and one of their best alongside Eric Weems in terms of covering those kickoffs. And so I think what ended up happening with the additions of Justin Bethel and Russell Gage this past offseason, there was really no real need, or at least the Falcons deemed there was really no real need to play Justin Hardy on those coverage units, because presumably they had adequate replacements with Bethel and Gage, and as well as other players that, like Marvin Hall, that filled in for Justin Hardy last season in that capacity. And then when you look at whatever his offensive role was, his primary role on offense was to be the backup to Mohamed Sanu, both as the Z wide receiver, the flanker, as well as being the slot receiver, the Y wide receiver. That's the letter Y, not the word. And so, like, that was his primary role. But once they drafted Calvin Ridley, that became Calvin Ridley's primary role, where he's Sanu's backup at that Y and that Z. And so, essentially, Justin Hardy became a third-string receiver for the Falcons in that regard. And so, with his offensive role marginalized, with his special teams role marginalized due to these personnel moves, the Falcons really didn't have a justification. Like, if they decided to go with a better punt returner, like, say, Marvin Hall, they really didn't have a reason to activate Justin Hardy on game days, or at least consistently week in and week out. And so in order to have a reason to activate him, and probably in part due to the fact that Justin Hardy has been a hardworking player, when they ask him to do things, he does it reasonably well. You know, like, I would compare him to a Jason Snelling, Brian Poole type of player. He's not great, but he's a solid, solid role player that most teams would love to have on their team, because he can do various things competently and fill in various roles. And so because they wanted to reward a guy and not basically marginalize that guy even further than what they had done with their personnel decisions, that they basically like, well, you know, we have nothing else really to do with Justin Hardy, so let's just let him return punts. And I think that's the main reason why the Falcons continue to stick with Justin Hardy as the punt returner, versus giving another guy an opportunity there, just because they just wanted to, you know, they liked the player and they wanted to reward the player. And you can certainly say maybe that wasn't the best decision that would help the team. But I understand, and it's at least a forgivable decision to me. It's not like baffling if that's the reasoning behind it. It's like, you know, sometimes you make decisions that aren't always in the, you know, say in say the best interest of the team, and try to be to maximize what is going to get the best 11 guys out there on the field, or the best 46 guys out there on the field. Sometimes you just like, look, you know, he's worked his tail off for 3+ years for us, and so to basically deactivate him because of various reasons, we're not going to do that. So that's my theory to as it is. And so because of that, I don't necessarily am like, I don't think Keith Armstrong is solely to blame. Like, it was simply as like, oh, he made a poor decision given the circumstances. I think it was sort of like various, you know, roster decision to personnel decisions that are above his pay grade, because Dan Quinn's in charge of the final 53 sort of pushed them in this direction. And so they were just trying to make the best out of a situation that wasn't great. So that's my explanation for the quote unquote terrible decision that Keith Armstrong made this year. I think other than that, the special teams was really solid. Kicking game was really good. You know, I multiple times said on this podcast that, you know, the demise of Matt Bosher has been overblown. Marvin Hall was arguably the best kickoff returner we've had in the Dan Quinn era. I think you can make an argument the coverage units were the best that they have been in the Dan Quinn era as well, in part due to them actually making some surgical upgrades with additions like Bethel and Gage, among others. Jordan Richards contributed to that. So, you know, I think, you know, when you gave Keith Armstrong, you know, and stopped asking him to try to make lemonade out of lemons, and, you know, maybe gave him some oranges in there to mix a refreshing citrus drink, you know, it actually tasted pretty good. So that's how I'll summarize it. So we'll talk a little bit more about Marquand Manuel coming up, as well as Steve Sarkisian a little later in the show. But before we do that, I do want to plug the two draft-related podcasts on the Locked On Podcast Network. They are the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast with hosts John Ledger and Trevor Sikkema, the Draft Dudes Podcast with hosts Joe Marino and Kyle Krabs. You can find them both wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, as well as at thedraftnetwork.com, where you can get written content by those four guys, as well as others, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So let's talk about Marquand Manuel. You know, I've been also defending Marquand Manuel on this podcast. I feel like he's gotten a bad rap. It's interesting because I felt like a lot of the criticism in 2017 for Steve Sarkisian was nitpicks. Like, oh, Steve Sarkisian's a bad play caller because I didn't like this third down call or I didn't like this red zone call. And, you know, basically saying like, you know, picking a handful of plays each and every week that you weren't a fan of and being like, that makes you a bad play caller, I think is a little bit unfair. And I feel like Sark didn't really get that type of scrutiny this year like he did get last year. But I think Marquand Manuel got a lot of that sort of scrutiny this year. I think, you know, obviously the Falcons defense did not play particularly well. I think a lot of that early on in the season in particular was due to not having some of their key defensive players in Keanu Neal and Deion Jones and Ricardo Allen and Neal being two of the sort of most consistent stabilizing forces, not only the secondary, but the entire defense. Deion Jones being one of their biggest playmakers. I think specifically looking at those games like Cincinnati and New Orleans, you can blame a healthy Falcons defense or a healthier Falcons defense should have won at least one of those games, if not both of those games. I wouldn't say that the Falcons would have, a healthy Falcons defense would have won the Pittsburgh game, but they certainly probably wouldn't have given up 45 points and at least made that game a little bit more competitive than what it actually was. I think after that point, blaming the injuries for at least the losses this season is a little bit silly. I think certainly the defense did not play well after that point. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people criticize Manuel for being, you know, playing too many quote unquote soft zone coverages. And from my perspective, I think that decision again was a little bit justifiable where I think the Falcons, you know, like I remember back in 2013, the Falcons got very conservative once Julio Jones and Roddy White and Steven Jackson and all those guys got hurt. And I thought that was a mistake because the Falcons didn't have the talent across their roster to play conservative. They needed to come out and be aggressive and score as many points as they could early in the game because their sort of typical style that they had won games in the first 5 years of the Mike Smith era prior to that 2013 season was they would basically play it tight to the vest and they would go out there and win it in the fourth quarter. And they just didn't have the talent to play that style of football during that middle stretch of the season. And understandably, they went like 1-5 during that stretch of the season, got blown out by a bunch of those teams in those five losses. I don't think that's the same case this year, and I think their conservative streak was a little bit more justifiable, only in the sense of we knew that this, certainly based off of how they performed in the first, month or two of the season, this offense was pretty good. And so I think the defense was basically playing, a bend but don't break style and like, let's not give up big plays, because my new mantra, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know what I'm talking about, big plays equals points. And so basically they didn't want to give up the big plays and not put this offense in a situation where they would have to play from behind and sort of, you know, be pressing and whatnot. So it was just like, let's just not lose the game early in the game. Let's be conservative. And so that's why the Falcons went with sort of this conservative mantra. I also think, you know, not having some of the injuries is where the injuries do factor in. You know, they couldn't necessarily be as confident in their man coverage on the back end, particularly given some of the issues they had at strong safety with Jordan Richards and Sherrod Neesman, not having that guy be able to lock down the tight end as they had with Keanu Neal certainly probably made them a little bit unwilling to sort of go, you know, play that cover one man style that they had often played over the previous two seasons as sort of like the backbone of their defense. And so I get the conservative streak that they had, and it's sort of I think it's justifiable. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with it, but I do think it's somewhat justifiable. So I'm not as mad at Marquand Manuel or this defense. You know, I think the circumstances they sort of found themselves in, you know, obviously they underachieved, no doubt about it. But I don't necessarily know how much of that was under their control. They had some major injuries early on, and several key players that needed to step up did not step up. I'm looking at you, Vic Beasley. I'm looking at you, Devondre Campbell, Duke Riley, Tack McKinley, Jordan Richards, Robert Alford, Desmond Trufant, et cetera. Not Desmond Trufant, I shouldn't include him, but basically it was like Grady Jarrett and Jack Crawford and DeMonte Casey, and that's really about it. And I guess Foye Olukun were only the guys that really stepped up that needed to, in my opinion. Maybe Brian Poole, although he had his ups and downs. But that's a conversation for another day. We'll revisit that topic in detail in future episodes. But that's why I'm not as sort of down on Marquand Manuel. But, you know, with the news that Dan Quinn's going to take over calling the defense, I think that makes sense. And that sort of is another reason that sort of signals that this is, you know, going to be a make-break season for Dan Quinn, because he's basically, I'm going to do it myself. If my job is going to hinge on this, I'm going to, you know, not put that in somebody else's hands. I'm assuming that, you know, we'll see an adjustment to the coaching staff. Maybe Raheem Morris will sort of switch back to the defense and help him out in that regard. They'll hire somebody else that will help them out. We'll see. But, you know, I know some people were expressing some concern about Dan Quinn doing this. I'm not as concerned about this, because they seemingly think it's going to take away from his ability to be the head coach and manage the game. You know, basically what I thought going into it, but also reading the replies I got on Twitter when I expressed this opinion, is that a lot of people don't agree with that. And I think it stems largely due to people still having lingering resentment over the Super Bowl when Dan Quinn was calling the defense. And, you know, you can certainly make a strong and convincing argument that the game management contributed. I'm not going to say cost in that game, but contributed to the loss in that game. And so people are worried about a repeat of that. But my philosophy when it comes to in-game management is that those things, they do, you know, if there is a, you know, so to speak, an in-game management gremlin that randomly pops up from time to time and will be like, I'm going to throw a wrench and I'm going to make your coach have a brain fart in terms of managing his timeouts and this clock and all those sorts of things and making bad challenges. But for the most part, I don't think that's a major issue. I think over the last couple of years, that's been an issue in maybe like, I don't know, like 4-5 games tops over the last 3-4 years. How many games have the Falcons lost in that period of time? Like 30. So I feel like for every game where that the game management gremlin shows up, there's like 4-5 games that you lose because of football reasons, because you can't rush the quarterback, because you can't block, because your quarterback throws too many interceptions, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel like people tend to have a tendency to overrate those game management issues as if there's something that come up all the time. They come up from time to time. You know, it seems like consistently you get one, maybe two of those games a year from Dan Quinn, which is unfortunate, but you also get like 5 games where the Falcons can't rush the quarterback and give up, you know, 35, 45 points. You also get, 4 or 5 games where the Falcons fail to score 17, you know, score more than 17 points. So I think people need to sort of, you know, pump the brakes in terms of putting how much emphasis that is on sort of the downfall of the team and whatnot. So I think this sort of has been a little bit overblown. We'll sort of see if that's the case or whatnot, if this exasperates that issue and suddenly it becomes an issue for not 1 or 2 games, but for, gasp, 3, maybe even 4 games. Like, you know, maybe it does, but I doubt it. So we'll see. And we'll wrap things up talking about, you know, the Steve Sarkisian firing. But before we do, let's go ahead and plug the NBA side of the Locked On Podcast Network. The NFL season is over, but that doesn't mean that you can't get your daily sports fix by checking out one of the 30 daily podcast devoted to the NBA teams, including the Locked On Hawks podcast with host Brad Rowland. Find out wherever you get your Locked On podcast, your NBA team every day. So, you know, look, Sark has been probably the most discussed topic on this podcast over the last 2 seasons. And, you know, I certainly over the next 10 or so minutes will not be able to get all my thoughts out on that, summarizing it. But I'll do my best to sort of hit the main points. And again, this is going to be a topic of discussion moving forward, because I don't think it's as simple as sort of, oh, the Falcons fired Sark and they're going to automatically get better. The rumors are sort of pointing to Daryl Bevel, former Seahawks offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel, being the front runner. You know, D. Orlando Ledbetter of the AJC said Dirk Cutter's in the mix. We'll see who else is in the mix. But, you know, the bevel thing, I'll comment on the bevel thing just quickly. The bevel thing makes sense because Dan Quinn has hired two offensive coordinators so far that he has not had experience working with. And you can argue did not necessarily, I wouldn't say failed him in the end, but certainly did not benefit him in the end. And so, you know, again, that's, you know, there's more nuance to that statement than anything, but I'm sure you understand what I'm saying. And so the reason why he's interested in Darryl Bevell, even if he's not necessarily the upgrade, is, again, going into this final season, having that familiarity. It's like, I know this is a known commodity for me, and I've already sort of struck out twice. Again, you can argue that. You can argue whether he actually struck out. But I've struck out twice with sort of two unknown coaches that I've never worked with before. And so we'll see if that works out for him, if it's Darryl Bevell or somebody else. I get it. Like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, that's a bad decision. I get why Dan Quinn's doing that, because, again, if he's coaching for his job in 2019, you know, going out there and being like, let's get someone who's completely different from what, you know, what I'm used to, probably is not going to necessarily help you put you in the best chance of success. But that's a topic of discussion that we will certainly be discussing over the next couple of months and weeks. Let's talk about Sark. And as I mentioned on, I think it was yesterday's podcast, sort of, I think, you know, I've been very critical of Sark over the last two seasons, probably as critical as anybody has been. But at the same time, I don't necessarily think it's all Sark's fault, anti-Sark. You know, I think he sort of was put in a situation that wasn't necessarily conducive to his success. I think, you know, we can say that in hindsight definitely now, but I think had we not been so enamored with the idea of, like, trying to basically make the case that the, you know, there was no going to be no regression, the offense was going to pick up, and we were basically trying to heal the wound that was that Super Bowl. Everything, you know, if you haven't got the theme, everything goes back. Everything wrong with this team goes back to that game, at least psychologically. Whether it actually does, you know, in terms of on the field, is debatable, but certainly psychologically goes back to that game. You know, we're not going to get over it. That's just one of the things that you, in order to get over it, you have to understand you're not going to get over it, but you, whatever. Anyway, that's another conversation for another day. Where was I? So I think because he was coming into a situation where he was basically thrust into the situation where he was following in the shadow of Kyle Shanahan in this super, super prolific offense. And given his background and his experience, he just was probably never going to be successful in that situation. And I think part of the reason why I can't necessarily automatically be like, the grass is greener, they got rid of Sark and they're going to automatically be better, is because the next offensive coordinator is kind of be in that same situation. And you can argue in some ways it's going to be in a worse situation, because he's also going to be in that shadow. Now, fortunately for him, he doesn't necessarily have to live up to the 540-point offense of 2016. He just has to exceed the, you know, the 414-point offense of 2018. And if he can do that, that's a good start. But, you know, given the fact that there may be, or the possibility, I shouldn't say fact, the possibility that this may be a one-and-done type of season, he's got to hit the ground running even more so. He's not going to get 2 years to figure it out like Sark did. He's going to get essentially two games to figure it out. And so that could be even a worse situation for this next guy. So we'll see if whoever that is, whether it's Bevell or somebody else, can navigate that situation. That's part of the reason why I'm very critical. All that being said, I'm very critical of Sark, but at the same time, I'm somewhat defensive of him. It's not sort of as clear cut as many people would like to make it out to be, like it's either all anti-Sark and he's the cause of all of our problems and et cetera, or it's like, oh, let's make excuses and let's defend Sark and it's not his fault and blah, 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 as other people sort of, in you know, on this world of the internet, people's opinions tend to gravitate towards the polls, and I'm always an adherent of staying stuck in the middle and arguing for against both sides. I'm just that guy shouting in the middle of the street, you know, King Kong ain't got nothing on me, to both sides. But to summarize Sark's tenure, I think there were two main issues that Sark dealt with in Atlanta that I think led to his downfall. The first of which is something I referred to on a recent episode, talking about the identity crisis. And I would recommend going back and listening to that podcast. I think it came, I can't remember if it was after the Ravens game. That week after, there was sometime in December where I broke it down, and I'm not going to necessarily rehash everything I said in that podcast, but I'll hit the main points. I think, you know, and it always comes back to Patrick DeMarco, but I think when the Falcons, basically the problem was that the Falcons, and I don't think this was specifically a Sark issue. I think the Falcons wanted to run the Kyle Shanahan offense, but Dan Quinn and company didn't necessarily give Sark the tools to run it by going replacement level at fullback. And they didn't do it in 2017 with Toy Lolo's contract, but they did it in 2018 with Paulson, and going replacement level at the tight end position, and seemingly investing all this energy and resources in the wide receiver with Gabriel in 2017. And one of the things I said when the Falcons let go of DeMarco was the only justification you can have for getting rid of Patrick DeMarco is if his role in the offense, his role in the foundation of the offense is going to be overtaken by Taylor Gabriel, and now you're going to be more of a three wide receiver offense. And the Falcons really weren't more of a three wide receiver offense in 2017 than they were the previous year. The only reason that they played more three wide receiver sets in 2017 than they did in 2016 because they found themselves behind in games more often in 2017, and so we're forced to pass the ball a lot more that season in certain situations than they were in 2016. We saw that continue in 2018, where they still tend to be more of that Shanahan-style fullback, tight end-heavy offense in terms of their personnel usage, but have basically replacement-level players at those spots, and then use a number one pick on a wide receiver in Calvin Ridley, and probably will continue to, you know, have all this money invested in their wide receivers and Julio and Sanu and now Ridley going into 2019, yet still utilize the fullback and tight end position. And the reason why I pointed that out is that that's confusing. You don't have a foundation of your offense. And that's why you have this identity crisis where it's like you want to be the Shanahan offense, but you don't really make the person, you don't know how to make the personnel moves to be that offense. And that's something I put more Dan Quinn, at least somewhat on Dan Quinn, given that he's in charge of the 53-man roster. And ultimately, those decisions are up to him. The other thing I would say about Sark is the other main thing is the, you know, it goes back to the statement I made previously, big plays equal points. And I think that's where the Falcons struggled with the consistency of being explosive. And I think the problem, this offense primarily is relies on its play action passing game to be explosive in 2017, more so than 2018. But they really sort of struggled with sort of, do we want to be a play action heavy offense? There were various points throughout the, particularly in the first half of the 2017 season, where they just seemed to abandon the play action for whole chunks of games, if not entire games on end. And that speaks again to the identity crisis. But there's nothing wrong with, you know, being relying on your play action passing game to generate those explosive plays matters. The problem is that it hasn't been as reliable under Sark as it has been in previous years for various reasons. But the Washington Cleveland game sort of illustrates that dichotomy, where in Washington, they really gash Washington with their play-action passing game, and that was very effective. And then one of the reasons why that was the most impressive game they had. But then the following week against Cleveland, Cleveland seemingly was prepared for it and made the adjustments to it. And the Falcons, instead of getting those 15 to 25-yard gains off of the play-action, because of the play of Cleveland's ends and Myles Garrett and Emmanuel Ogba, those turned into five-yard checkdowns to Logan Paulson and Austin Hooper and et cetera. And so when when that's the primary way, and suddenly you can't be explosive anymore because that's the only way that you can generate big plays, that's a problem. And so you're not scoring as many points. The other issue that I had with the Falcons in their lack of explosiveness is too much of their offense was sort of reliant on sort of individual players making individual plays. And what I mean by that is those times where Matt Ryan would have to step up in the pocket, extend plays because the initial design of the play was well covered, and only because Matt Ryan bought himself in the play and his receivers another 3 to 5 seconds of time outside the pocket led to them being able to convert that third down or generating that big play down the field. And then you had a lot of big plays where the Falcons was just reliant on whether it was Freeman or Sanu or Julio or Ridley or whoever it was, sort of making a defender miss or a defender being out of position, blowing a coverage, making a poor angle and whatnot. And then if that happened, then, you know, you would have an 8-yard reception turn into, you know, a 25-yard gain or something like that. But it wasn't the design of the offense that was generating those explosive plays. It was just individual players. And it goes back to one of the things that people harped on quite a bit last year and to a certain extent this past year in 2018, which was, you know, how much execution was important. It's not Sark's fault because they need to execute. And the reason why execution became so important is because the design of the offense just wasn't really conducive to winning in that way. And the last bit I'll say is the reason why that's important is because, like, if that's what you're relying on, that's going to be problematic come January when you're playing some of these better defenses in the league. And we've seen this throughout the Sark era where the Falcons, against the quality teams, the quality defense and the quality opponents that they play, their offense struggled. And the reason for that is because good defenses do not generally have these breakdowns in coverage, do not have a strong safety out of position that leave, you know, Mohamed Sanu wide open for a big play against Tampa Bay, do not miss a tackle that take a poor angle or whatever that lead to that. And you see that reflected not only last season when we lost to Philadelphia, as well as, you know, losses, midseason losses to Minnesota, et cetera. But just look at this 2018 season. The Falcons played had five games against four opponents that are currently in the playoffs: Philadelphia, New Orleans, Dallas, and Baltimore. And they played New Orleans twice, so that's five games. You look at the scoring output they had in those games: 12 against Philadelphia, 37 in the first Saints game, 19 against Dallas, 17 against the Saints in the second game, and 16 against Baltimore, right? And so you do the average of that over the course of those five games, that's on average 20 points, right? If you remove the one quote-unquote outlier there, the Saints game, that's 16 points per game. That's not going to cut it. And, you know, again, I continue to forget the exact stat that I pointed out, but basically the Falcons' win percentage in games where they score 23 or 24 or less points is abysmal in the Dan Quinn era, because this defense isn't good enough to win games. If you're only going to be able to reliably score 17 to 20 points, this defense isn't good enough to win games 20 to 17. It's not good enough to win games 17 to 14. Now, hopefully there is some time in the future they will be good enough, but contrary to popular opinion, this is why we make a big deal, or at least I make a big deal about the hype, the top 10 hype, is that they're not on the cusp of being that type of defense. Or they've never been on the cusp of that. I mean, you know, maybe a miracle can happen and suddenly, you know, they have the greatest offseason of all time and suddenly morph into that defense in 2019. But it's doubtful. If they're going to be that type of defense, it's probably going to come in 2020, 2021 or later or whatever. And who knows if Dan Quinn's going to be around for that. So the larger point is the main issue, if there's anything to blame and question about Sark, is the ceiling of this team in January. It's not that Sark wasn't a capable regular season offensive coordinator, given, you know, you look at the production of the Falcons offense overall. It was whether or not this team can win with Sark in the postseason against these quality defenses. And all five or all four of those teams I mentioned, and, you know, have to varying degrees, have capable defenses. Not, you know, the Saints are probably the worst defense I mentioned out of that group, and their defense is at least above average. Like, you're not sitting there saying, like, oh, that defense is a massive liability going into the postseason. Like, it seemed like early in the season when the Falcons dropped 37 points, but they've been significantly better in the back half of the season since that point. So I think that's sort of the larger point with Sark. And again, it goes back sort of the psychology is, why is Sark getting fired? Oh, because he's not good enough to win this team a Super Bowl. Right? That's basically it. It's not because he's not good enough to get this team to the postseason. It's because he's not good enough to get this team to a Super Bowl. Right? And so the question is the next offensive coordinator going to be good enough? I remain skeptical of that, just because those type of offensive coordinators typically don't grow on trees. And certainly, I don't think Dan Quinn has really worked with any of those guys. I mean, the two most prolific offensive coordinators that he's worked with in his career dating back is basically Daryl Bevel and Greg Knapp. And I don't know, you know, I know Bevel won a Super Bowl in Seattle, but I don't think it was because of his superb play calling. It was more to Dan Quinn's coaching on the defense, along with Pete Carroll and other factors. So, you know, these things are up in the air. And so we'll sort of see if the Falcons come through better for this. I think there's reason to be optimistic. I think there's reason to be hopeful. I certainly can sit here and say, with the dismissal of Sarkisian, I am at least for now optimistic that maybe they can bring in a better offensive coordinator that is capable of being at least more consistent in terms of bringing a winning climate for this team come January, should they find themselves in a January game in 2019. They got some work to do to get there. It's not automatic. I'm optimistic, but it's not automatic. That's what I'll say. And that's going to be something that we will continue to talk about in this podcast. Again, there's a whole lot more to say about this offense, a whole lot more to say about this defense, as well as hashtag special teams matter on this podcast. And we will be talking about that in the coming days, weeks, and months throughout the offseason. So I just wanted to sort of get my main thoughts, the main bullet points out here, and we'll take a deeper dive in some of these issues that I talked about and bring up some other issues as well in the coming days and weeks with this offense. And hopefully, you know, the Falcons will have a hire soon. I don't know. They don't have to rush into the decision, but, you know, hopefully they deliberate and make a good decision at all three of these spots, should they make additions there. And we'll see what happens. So if you have your specific feedback that you want to provide, you can do so to me on Twitter. I'm at FalFans. If it's podcast related, just go ahead, send it over to the show's Twitter handle. That's Locked On Falcons. Locked On Falcons is the name of the Facebook page. LockedOnFalcons@mail.com is the email address. And you can leave a comment at FalFans.com where the podcast is posted daily. So I will say we'll probably bring on some other people to share their insights with this move in the coming days to finish out this week and kick off our 2019 podcast season with some great takes. I hope you guys enjoyed your new year. I hope you guys didn't party too hard celebrating the demise of Steve Sarkisian, the demise of Marquand Manuel, the demise of Keith Armstrong, as many of you have been hopefully wishing for over the last couple of seasons on that New Year's Eve. So we'll start 2019 off in the right way. Until then.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.